This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're marking our 30th anniversary as a daily NPR program with a collection of interviews from our first couple of years. I was lucky enough to have been conducting interviews while some of the icons of bebop and the big band era were still alive. We're going to hear three of those interviews today. First, we go back to 1987 for an interview with Max Roach, one of the inventors of modern jazz drumming. Together with Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Dizzy Gillespie, Roach helped formulate the language of bebop. In the mid-50s, Roach teamed up with trumpeter Clifford Brown to form what many jazz fans regarded as the quintessential bop group of the time. In the early 60s, Roach recorded the album We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite, some of the first jazz music inspired by the civil rights movement. We started with this 1954 Clifford Brown Max Roach quintet recording of Daoud. Max Roach, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
How did you first meet some of the people who you became very close with and made now classic music together with? I'm thinking of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Did they find you? Did you find them?
Well, Dizzy Gillespie heard me at a jam session in a place called Monroe's Uptown House. Clark Monroe was the brother-in-law of Billie Holiday's first husband, Jimmy Monroe, and he was like a patron for young talent in these after-hour clubs. These after-hour clubs would open up at 4 in the morning and go until 8. So we could work those places and still go to school, Bud Powell and a crowd of us. Well, he heard me. He was at Cab Calloway. He heard me. He says, someday when I get my own band, when I leave Cab Calloway, I would like for you to play for me. That's how I met Dizzy, and Dizzy introduced me to Coleman Hawkins. I got my first record date. And Dizzy was kind of like the catalyst of that whole movement that we call bebop. You know, he brought Charlie Parker to New York and Bud Powell and all these wonderful people. He kind of had a group around him, you know, and I was just fortunate enough to be part of that. But that's how I really got started.
You were one of the first drummers to play bebop, and you were one of the first people to figure out how to drum in the kind of fiery sessions that were being played. What were some of the challenges that presented to you?
Well, when they played fast, they played very fast. Instrumental virtuosity prevailed because during the war, you know, we had an extra, the Second World War, we had an extra 20% cabaret taxes, very complex. To put it very simply, it was if an entrepreneur hired, he had to pay for, say, he had to pay a city tax, like in New York, he had to pay a state tax and a federal tax. On top of that, he had to pay a 20% government tax called entertainment tax if he had a singer, if he had public dancing or dancing on a stage, or a comedian. This really heralded the demise of big bands during that time. This just tax was just awful, you know. So the people who really got the jobs were the virtuoso instrumentalists. Everybody went home and practiced, and then that was the beginning of bebop, like the people who, so Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Shearing, the virtuoso players were the ones who people would come and sit down. Everybody began to sit and listen to the music rather than get up and dance to it. That was the beginning of it.
What rhythms had you been playing before, and what rhythms did you shift into playing when you started playing bop? Because you really had to invent new rhythms.
And yeah, I had help too. I had a lot of help. My mentors were people like Big Sidney Catlett and Chick Webb, Joe Jones with the Count Basie Band. For folks who don't know, these were people who played with Louis Armstrong, and Sidney Catlett did, and later went with Benny Goodman. Sidney Catlett took Gene Krupa's place when Krupa started his own band. But all these folks, they were doing pretty much the same thing, but only in large band contexts. When you played in a small band, you had to do more. More was required of you because there were less people. It was like playing in a string quartet vis-a-vis a symphony orchestra. It's much more interesting for the individual player. Of course, an orchestra is interesting for the composer and the conductor and the soloist. But when you play in a smaller context, everybody has to do more to fill up the sound. So this was required of us. I don't think we were aware of it, excepting that that very small band I worked in, the first one was Dizzy's. I worked in small bands, of course, all around the city at that time, but Dizzy was the one that his band with Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford and Bud Powell or Charles Mingus, that was all the virtuoso people got together. And that's, but we knew that everybody had to be kind of busy. So consequently, you heard more drums, you heard more piano, you heard more this and that and the other to fill it out. That's to put it very simply, of course.
Right. Well, to put it less simply, we'll hear some of what you were playing then. This is from the mid-1940s, and this is my guest, Max Roach, as recorded with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and we're going to hear Coco. Coco is recorded in 1945 with my guest Max Roach on drums and Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Does it bring back memories for you? Do you listen back to that
sure
much?
It sure does. It'd be Charlie Parker at that time as well as Dizzy. The music was very, very fresh, and I guess you would equate it with what we hear today from people like Anthony Braxton. At least they treated us that way. We were the new breed on the scene, and they would say things, the critics would say, Dizzy sounds like he's playing with a mouthful of marbles, and Charlie Parker was playing scales from a saxophone book, just only scales, and Max Roach dropped bombs. I don't know, but it was interesting. Bud Powell had no left hand, and It was, you know, we were criticized, but some of it was valid, I thought. You know, we had a long way to go, you know.
Was this the life you had planned on when you wanted to become a jazz musician? Because you started playing at a time when the big bands were still around. Mm-hmm. And being a jazz musician meant going on tour with Earl Hines or Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, one of the big bands. But you actually came of age. You know, you grew right after that. Mm-hmm. You came of age in a time when it was small groups, as you were saying before. And the life just became very different.
It did. Well, I hadn't planned on really becoming, taking jazz music that seriously at the time. But the war and all the things that did happen. And then while I was in my senior year at Boys High, I'd met this gentleman, Clark Munro, and worked in his after-hour club. Well, Sonny Greer, Duke's great drummer, was ill, and most of the great drummers were in the Army, like Joe Jones, Sidney Catlett, etc. I could read music. So, Clark, because in those after-hour spots, you played, as I said before, for Shake Dancer, you played Cachaturian, you did all kinds of things. And when Sonny Greer got sick, Duke Ellington called Mr. Munro up did he know a drummer who could play a show? Duke was at the New York Paramount. He said, I got a kid who works at my club that plays a show. And I went down to the New York Paramount, make a long story short, got on the stage and looked at Mr. Greer's music stand. There was no music stand and no music. And I couldn't play by ear at that time. You know, I was about 17. So everything was by ear. So Mr. Ellington, before the curtain came up, he looked at me and saw the fright, the fear in my face and said, keep one eye on me and one eye on the act on the stage. And I made it through, but then I made up my mind I wanted to be in this area of the music because Duke had all the theater and the drama and the pageantry was just surrounded him when he presented a show, and that's when I really decided that was what I wanted to do.
In the 1960s, in the early 1960s, you started to play music inspired by the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Had you become an activist then?
Well, I guess we always have been. You know, people ask me that quite often, but I go back to Bessie Smith with Black Mountain Blues and then to Duke Ellington with his Black, Brown, and Beige. It's always been there. Leadbetter always spoke about the issues and the times that existed. And many of the old black folk singers from the South, the street musicians, dealt with it. And so to me, it was just I had an opportunity to say something, and I used them. In fact, the suite was commissioned by the youth movement of the NAACP, and we premiered it here in Philadelphia at one of their conventions. That's what it was. In 1960, it was. We were originally commissioned to do something for the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, and so that's how it came about.
Was it at all risky for you to do politically inspired music? Were you going to? Did you run into any trouble in getting recording dates afterwards or club dates because of your involvement in the civil rights movement? And, you know, I don't think so.
I'll tell you what did happen that was very positive. It sneaked into South Africa, or rather it went into South Africa, it didn't sneak in. It was taken into South Africa as a jazz musician's album until people read the liner notes put out by Nat Hentoff, and the pieces were a comment. Of course, Oscar Brown Jr., of course, was the lyricist on the work. It was a comment on the things that happened in Charlottesville, the massacre, and things like that. So when the authorities in South Africa realized that this was not just simply a jazz album, they banned it and hit the UPI and AP, and it became a celebrity record. And it sold more records, I guess, than anything I had ever made at that time. So something came out of it because of that. And the musicians from South Africa, like Hugh Masekela and Dollar Brand, they were listening and buying it and taping it and things like that. But it's amazing how things turn around, see? So the Freedom Now Suite, I've always been an activist. At that time, of course, my children were young, but you're always thinking about, you know, their future as well. And it has to be, if they're going to come up and be responsible human beings, they have to have education and have things like everyone else has, and the society has to accommodate that. So I guess I've always been an activist, because of that.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today and talking with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Max Roach recorded in 1987. He died 20 years later at the age of 83.